The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Thanks, Ken. We could have done a karaoke thing with the music. My 10-year-old daughter actually just got selected yesterday to be the singer in front of the band. And if there was ever a girl who was destined to be a singer in front of a band, it's her. She came home and she said, "It's official, I'm now a triple threat." I didn't know she even knew that phrase, but so I showed her Freddie Mercury singing with Queen in front of Live Aid. I said, "Learn from this man," and Bono at the same concert not singing, and I said, "Learn from this man also." And so she's ready to stand in front of a big band, a big crowd, but she's not here, so instead you're stuck with me. Esther, there is the text there printed in front of you, and we're going to keep going through the story. When my dear late father was diagnosed with early onset dementia, one of the standard diagnostic tests was, tell me who the Prime Minister is today. And that wouldn't seem a fair question today to ask of people struggling with potentially with dementia, or of any of us, I would think. And the passage today that we're looking at is about the spill of a Prime Minister. It's about the removal of a Prime Minister who was a tyrant, who was terrible, who was evil in many ways, but it's got all the elements that we still find with changes of leadership. I was in Parliament House a month back now when the spill was on, and during that week there was all the things that we've so easily come to associate with it. You know, there was the chasing of numbers, there was the public positioning, there was the smell of fear. I was supposed to be meeting with senators who were so distracted by what was going on. I actually came back to Sydney. It was a complete waste of time just being there. But those questions of who is in power, who's plotting against who are those 43 names, and are there going to be more that add themselves? Who has power in this situation? Breathless updates of the latest sightings of people at Chinese restaurants, accusations of bullying. And at the end of it, when the bloodletting was done, a Prime Minister heading to New York who kept tweeting his revenge, and still does, I think, in some ways. But all of that pales in comparison to what we see in the mighty Persian Empire, the great world power at the time. The stakes were higher there when a coup was on. And when a Prime Minister was spilled, he was then spilled on a stake in front of all. In the Persian Empire, we're told by Herodotus again that when they defeated the Babylonians in one battle, there were 3,000 of them that they impaled on stakes. It was a thing that the Persians did. They were proud of it. They boasted of it in some of the histories which we have. And you can go to the British Museum today and walk around and see a scene from one of their friezes of the siege of Lachish in northern Israel, and see some of the Judeans there who are being impaled by the conquering army which has come through. And at the time, this kind of violence was just the way that the world worked. And remember, in this story, we already have this genocidal order which has gone out, that all of the Jews throughout the Persian Empire are to be killed. And Esther has agreed to Mordecai's request to go forward, to risk her own life, to come into the presence of a king to plead for her people. The king at this stage still does not know that Esther is Jewish. We don't know how he's going to react, and we've seen before that when his queen, Queen Vashti, doesn't answer his summons, then you know, that's the end of her role. There's real terror for her, and yet she knows that she's called to this moment. And she says to Mordecai, if it pleases the king, let the king... I will go into the king, though it's against the law, and if I perish, I perish. And to prepare for it, she fasts for 3 days, probably has people praying for her, although that's not recorded, but for 3 days there, she's without food, looking haggard and pale from fasting. She approaches the king, and the king at that point has got a bodyguard there with an axe, and he's got a scepter. And it's a question of which he reaches for. Will she be pardoned with the scepter, or will the axe swing? And the king, his pity aroused, allows her to approach, asks what he can do. And yet she comes back with this strange request. You see that there where that number 4 is. If it pleases the king, let the king, together with Haman, the prime minister, come today to a banquet that I've prepared for him. Now, does that sound a little strange to you? I mean, the queen hasn't seen the king for a month. She's had this opportunity to ask for something, and she asks for a lovely, cosy, romantic dinner for 3. And she phrases it as saying that she's prepared, a banquet has been prepared for him, and yet we're not told who the him is. The ambiguity is there in the Hebrew as well. It's got to be the king, right? And yet the way she asks it is strange. But within hours, the 3 of them are there together, looking across the candlelight, enjoying the fine wine and each other's company. And the king once more is inquiring, "What can I do for you, Esther?" And Xerxes is drinking again. Nobody does drunken banquet quite as much as the king of the Persian Empire. It's one of the big themes going through the book, is how much he enjoys his wine and banqueting and feasting. And doubtless there's laughing and opining and all is well. And as he asks what is the petition that she has, he's still not getting a straight answer. And the king's got to be wondering at this point. And Esther here doesn't come straight out and plead for her people. There's no kind of get straight to the point. She knows that's not going to be the effective negotiating strategy to adopt here in this situation. Timing is everything in politics and power, and at this point the timing is wrong and the power is wrong. She knows that Haman still has the power in this situation. The favour of the king is still with him, and it's too early to move against someone with such great power. She, though, does execute a strategy which we'll see does arouse the suspicion of the king. When asked, "What can I do for you?" she comes back this time a bit less subtle. "Let the king and Haman come to the banquet I will prepare for them. And then I will answer the king's question." For them? For them? The queen's words aren't lost on Haman. As he goes to his own little after party where he's invited his wife and some friends to, so that he can boast about how incredible he is and what access he has into the halls of power. He's drunk on her words. "Even Esther the queen brought no one with the king to the banquet she prepared other than myself, and tomorrow too I'm invited to her." Oh, along with the king. The king at this point is kind of relegated to a footnote in Haman's mind, and he is the one who's really got access into the halls of power. He boasts about his wealth and his son and how wonderful his rule is to all those who would listen. And yet we're also told, and see it there with number 9, that he sees Mordecai at the gate, who won't honour him and who doesn't fear him and won't bow before him. And he's riled up by that. The very moment where all should be saying how wonderful Haman is and how much power he has, there's this stubborn Mordecai who will not acknowledge him and his power. And his wife says to him, "Well, look, you know, you are coming into such great power. Let's just kill this guy. Do to him what you're doing to all the Jewish people. Erect a stake. That will be the end of him." And that same night, though, the words of the queen are doing their work on the king. And as he lies in his bed, he's unable to sleep. He's tossing back and forth, going over the things that she's said and the provocation that she's laid out for him. What is it that keeps you awake at night? What are the questions that would stop you from sleeping? Well, for the king, there's a fear and there's a paranoia. Is it paranoia? He ends up being assassinated by bodyguards. He's a man who needs to be professionally paranoid. As the king, Xerxes needs to always understand who's trying to seize power from him and how it is that he can hold on to it. And the queen's words have to be a bit disturbing. Why did she want this banquet for him? Why did she so desire the presence of Haman there? And had she actually said, as he remembered, that the banquet was intended to honour both of them? Is Haman to be included with the king as one who holds power? Why does she want to see this prime minister so much? Maybe she has an interest in him which she shouldn't, or maybe he has an interest in her which he shouldn't. And the tossing and the turning continues, and doubtless he's thinking of the possibility of a conspiracy being prosecuted against him, an attempt on his life. Could that be the purpose of the banquet? But Haman's the one who's trusted with all this power. He's raised him to prominence. Surely he wouldn't seize after that power from him. Surely he can be trusted. And so he calls his servants and has the chronicles read to him in the hope of finding something about Haman's actions and who can be trusted and who can't. And as they begin to read, they return to the attempt on his life that triggers Haman's installation in the story. And there the story is told about how Mordecai had overheard the plot to assassinate the king, but had never been rewarded for it, never been honoured, no promotion ever given to him. Instead, Haman is the one who is honoured, who is promoted. Mordecai is the one who nothing is done for. And as he's going over those events and he's thinking about what we've seen already in the story of Esther, he's got to think that it was Haman who'd said to him that there are these people who are of no benefit to you, who are a harm and a threat to you. And yet Mordecai was the one who'd saved the life of the king. What is Haman's role in this? Is he involved in some plot to destroy those who would save the king? He certainly has this mania for control. We hear no names of other advisors being told anymore. It's all Haman, Haman, Haman. And that desire for control was probably why he was elevated in the first place. He was someone who everything could be given to. And yet, how much has the king given to him? Haman at this point has the signet ring of the king. He's able to make laws and decrees, and he's got access to the treasury. Now he's having banquets with the king's wife, and who knows what else he might have. And with the dawn, Haman, who'd been provoked by Mordecai, appears again before the king with the intention of having Mordecai executed. He's had the stake installed, but the story is starting to turn. And as Haman seeks to consolidate his own power and have all honour him, the king has shifted into this contrary state of mind. He's weighing whether Haman might benefit from being taken down a notch or two. And in a very comical scene, which we won't go into now, he asks Haman what should be done for the one who honours the king. And Haman, thinking the king's speaking of him, he gives a description of, oh, give him a robe and a horse and lead him through the city and say how wonderful he is. And then the king says, well, do that for Mordecai. Hilarious kind of reversal of fortunes there. And we see the nobodies in this world being elevated and the strong man being humiliated as he needs to lead Mordecai in this procession. But we come to the second banquet that the queen had asked for. And for the third time, the king asks Esther what might be done for her. And this time, there is no hesitation in the queen's voice. She's picked up the reversals that are starting to take place. She knows that her time is now, And she appeals in words that she probably rehearsed 100 times and says, "If I've found favour for you, with you, Your Majesty, if it pleases you, grant me my life. This is my petition. And spare my people. This is my request. For I and my people have been sold to be destroyed, killed and annihilated. And if we'd merely been sold as male and female slaves, I would have kept quiet, because no such distress would justify disturbing the king." And the king asked, "Who is it? Which is he who's inclined his heart to do so?" And the Esther answers, "An adversary and an enemy, this vile Haman." And the king sees, his temperature rises, and livid he storms out in the garden. He's lost all control of the situation. His wife is a Jewess, and Haman has been plotting. Like, did he know this? He's tried to murder her and her people. How can he rule now? Who can he rely on? This Prime Minister's dangerous, he's insane, he's lust to rule, he would murder the Queen herself. And the King, who wants to rule his empire, is struggling again even to rule his own house. He's finding this chaos that's taking place within the relationships he thought he could trust the most, and he's lost control of his wife, and he's lost control of his Prime Minister. And all of this comes from those words of Esther that have been whispered into the ear of the king. And you see the way her stratagem has been deployed so brilliantly. And as the king comes back in from the garden, he's confronted with a scene where Haman is there before the queen on the couch. Like, there's this thing that only the king should be there in that presence at that moment, and Haman sees it and exclaims, "Is he going to molest the queen while she's with me in the house?" And as soon as he says this, they cover Haman's face. No longer is he going to have access to the king. Here is one who is on the out. Haman is a dead man. And as they wonder about what's to be done, one of the bodyguards comes forward and says, "Well, you know, there is this stake out here. It's reaching to 50 cubits. It's outside Haman's house, and he's had it set up for Mordecai, who's spoke to help the king, and the king's order goes out, impale him on it." And so they impale Haman on the pole that he'd set up for Mordecai, and the king's fury subsides. There's this reversal of fortunes that takes place at this moment, where we see that the young queen had saved her people. Esther herself caused all this to happen. Her courage, her resourcefulness, her initiative. And yet, on the biblical view too, we've got to say that as much as she is this independent political agent influencing human affairs in the way she does, we also see God's will brought to bear in history through her. Call it providence, call it a miracle, but the God who is not named is at work through Esther herself. His strong hand, his outstretched arm are at work in her, but in a hidden way, in her intelligence, her cunning, her courage, her decisiveness, her political acumen. By coming into worldly royalty in the strange way that she did, Esther placed herself in a position to be able to act in the service of another king entirely. In refusing the way of complacency or cowardice or silence, in going through that time where she fasts and she overcomes her fears, and she goes forward in weakness with this audacious, cunning plan, she pulls it off. She's one of the great heroines of the Bible. Her choices and her actions are done without any explicit command from God, any revelation of how it will work out or not, and yet she's the instrument of God's will in this story. She acts in a way that God acts through history, redemptively, to save his people, and through them, to save the world. And he does it with weakness rather than power. So there's a lot of lessons for us today in that. And in a world where sometimes it feels like people of faith see politics as a place for fanaticism, where they can have almost divine power and achieve anything, or the opposite extreme, where there's a political cynicism from people of faith that just despair of politics altogether, we see in Esther a different course, where people are actually responsible before God to act in ways that use power, not for their own greatness and glory, not to make themselves grand, but instead to serve, to save. And that's what Esther does. She throws everything she has, her courage, her loyalty, her intelligence, her beauty, into this political effort to save her people. And as she does everything, her actions end up amounting to a miracle, as God himself acts in and through her in history. Now, that's not where the story of Esther ends. It's where this series ends. We may come back to finish it, but we're left with a legal problem. The edict has gone out, and the laws of the Persians and Medes can't be changed. The order for the destruction of the Jewish people has gone out. It can't be changed even by the king. So I want to leave you with that dilemma. How can that be solved? Encourage you to read it. Promise you that one day we might come back to it. But to say that Esther herself is a great story worth reading, even for what we've seen so far. And open it up for Q&A. Okay, all right, a few questions here. Did Xerxes know that Mordecai was one of the Jews about to be destroyed when he asked what honour and recognition he could receive? Well, Mordecai seems to have been quite circumspect in kind of outing himself until Haman comes to power. You remember that once Haman comes to power, he refuses to bow, refuses to acknowledge that he actually has any kind of power. And at that point, the questioning of him is revolving around his faith. And so at that point, it's certainly clear that he's taking a stand because of his Jewish faith. So yes, I think at that point he does. Significance of the Persian king having a book of Chronicles, noticing the Old Testament cap. Yeah, look, some of these books of history we still have fragments of and bits of. And again, the British Museum was wonderful at having an empire that plundered Persia and brought much of it back to London. So you could go to Iran and see this stuff, or you could go to London. And we do have a lot of sources, including sources that speak of Mordecai, who is actually mentioned. Is Zeresh the bad wife and the sort of anti-Esther? I hadn't considered that. But yeah, look, the place of the wives is interesting, isn't it? So you have Vashti, the wife who won't come into the presence of the king at the start. And there's this fear that all the wives in Persia will also start disobeying their husbands. And then we are introduced to this next wife, Esther, and then I think Zeresh, you'd have to connect the story somehow. So it'd be interesting to think a bit more about that. We learn about the power of nobodies. What about the nobodies without power who don't have influence and don't find themselves in a situation to use power? Well, that's the situation of all the Jewish people throughout the Persian Empire who are under the sentence of death and don't have this access into the court. So what do they depend on? Well, they depend on God saving them somehow. That's their hope. That's always been the hope of the Jewish people and of God's people as we go through in the New Testament, that God will keep his promises to save his people. And the way he does it is through somebody who appears weak, who appears a nobody, who appears to have no power, who's rejected by the powers of this world, and who ends up being the one who has all the power. We see it in Esther, we see it in Christ. And so the place of the nobodies, like you and me, is to look on the ones who God has chosen to save those nobodies, I think. That's a short answer. Is not parliamentary democracy the answer to this sort of dictatorial problem? I'm not sure if that's a comment on Esther or our politics at the moment. I joke. No, look, I think I think parliamentary democracy, Westminster system, rule of law, checks and balances, I think a lot of that does come actually out of a Judeo-Christian understanding of the human propensity to grasp after power and the need to distribute it wisely amongst different people. So, yeah, look, I think there is something to be said for that, and there may even be something to be said for a monarchy, properly understood as well, if you think through some of this stuff. But throughout the history of the Bible, you certainly see a whole lot of different political systems being played out, and the problem isn't the problem and the solution isn't the political system, but the people. You know, if people were good, we wouldn't need politics at all. We wouldn't need law at all. You know, you go back to the very first problems that people start having in Adam and Eve. You've got a pretty good system at work there in the Garden of Eden, and yet it's corrupted because of the people who are within it. So any kind of system we build, be it parliamentary democracy or constitutional monarchy or anything like that, is an attempt to overcome some of that. We look forward to a kingdom that will be one where people aren't the problem. I think that's the greater hope.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.